in the 7th century AD, he co-opted the site where stood the Temple of the Moon God with its fabulous tower for the construction of a grand mosque. It seems that the temple was destroyed to make way for the mosque, but that Ghanam offered the Sabians an alternative site in the city where they were permitted to build a new temple. They continued to practice their star worship there without significant disruption until the 11th century AD, when either in 1032 or in 1081, accounts are conflicting, a new generation of Muslim rulers turned against them, suppressed their faith, and destroyed their last temple. 2 centuries later, the Mongol invasions began, and Harran was frequently the scene of fierce conflicts. In a succession of episodes in 1259, 1262, and 1271, the city's Islamic places of worship were destroyed. The Grand Mosque still lies in ruins today, but when we remember that the Temple of the Moon God once stood here under a lofty tower, it's curious that the one almost intact architectural remnant with a square base measuring only 4 meters, 13 feet on each side, stands more than 50 meters, 164 feet tall, and overlooks the Harran Plain, just as its Sabian predecessor did. No doubt it is merely a surviving minaret of Ibn Ghanam's Grand Mosque. The architecture is definitely Islamic. Still, it is thought-provoking, to say the least, that local people refer to it to this day as the Astronomical Tower, as though preserving an ancient memory of the time when their Sabian ancestors climbed the long-vanished spire of the Temple of the Moon God to observe the heavens. The few archaeological expeditions mounted in Harran from the 1950s onwards, while finding a number of inscriptions relating to the Moon God, have as yet revealed no physical traces of the pre-Islamic temples. A team from the Chicago Oriental Institute was about to start a major dig around the ruins of the Grand Mosque in 1986, but it seems that the Turkish authorities insisted on such restrictive practices that the project had to be abandoned. Current excavations by Harran University and the Sanliurfa Museum Directorate show little interest in recovery of substantive remains from the city's pre-Islamic period. Thus far, based on the minimal archaeology done, datable artifacts from Harran itself go back to around 5000 BC, though there's every possibility that older remains will be found with further excavations. At a settlement mound called Asagi Yarimka, a few kilometers northwest of the city, characteristic Halaf monochrome wares dating to 6000 BC have been collected. And 6 kilometers south of Harran, excavations since 2006 by Turkish archaeologist Nurettin Yardimici have established the existence of an even older permanent settlement dated to 8000 BC. Since 8000 BC, 10,000 years ago, marks the approximate epoch in which Göbekli Tepe was abandoned and the last of its stone circles deliberately buried, I was intrigued to learn that the site of Yardimici's excavations has been known since time immemorial as Tel Idris, in other words, the settlement mound of Idris. This is interesting because Idris in the Quran is the name of the biblical prophet Enoch, the 7th of the 10 patriarchs who lived in the times before the flood. To be specific, Enoch is the son of Jared, the father of Methuselah, the grandfather of Lamech, and the great-grandfather of Noah himself. Moreover, Muslim traditions associate Idris Enoch with Hermes. The Persian Islamic philosopher Abu Mashar, AD 787 to 886, expresses the matter as follows. The name Hermes is a title. Its first bearer, who lived before the flood, was he whom the Hebrews call Enoch, whose name in Arabic is Idris. The Haranians declare his prophethood. This antediluvian Enoch Idris Hermes was a master of the sciences, especially astronomy. In addition, he wrote many books whose wisdom he preserved on the walls of Egyptian temples lest it be lost. It was he who constructed the pyramids. Abu Mashar's comments contain strong echoes of the Edfu building texts, also supposedly derived from lost antediluvian books and inscribed on the walls of the Temple of Horus, to ensure that their message would not be lost. And the sense here that the pyramids are remotely ancient and were built by Hermes, that master of astronomy, the Egyptian Thoth, as the reader will recall, finds resonance with the tradition of the number of the secret chambers of the sanctuary of Thoth, reported in chapter 11, which, in historic times, the pharaoh Khufu wished to consult and copy in his own construction works at Giza. Once again, confronted by such material, it doesn't seem unreasonable to suppose that we may have stumbled across the traces of a project set in motion by the survivors of a global flood cataclysm to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods. Wherever this project took root, it seems to me its essence was a tradition passed down from generation to generation by initiated masters, and thus theoretically capable of implementation in any place and in any epoch when the time was right. With their ability to blend in and survive changing circumstances, with their knowledge of the astronomical qualities of the pyramids preserved until at least as late as the 13th century AD, and with their very name, as Salim Hassan rightly recognized, derived from spa, the ancient Egyptian word for star, the Sabians of Haran have all the hallmarks of carriers of the secret tradition. Mystery of the Watchers. Apart from his genealogy in the line of patriarchs before Noah, and the enigmatic statements that he walked with God and was mysteriously taken up by God without experiencing death, the canonical Bible has nothing else to tell us about Enoch. Happily, much more information is available in several ancient non-canonical works, in other words, works that biblical redactors, for one reason or another, chose not to include within the officially sanctioned scriptures. Of these, the most famous by far is the Book of Enoch. Prior to the 18th century, scholars had believed it to be irretrievably lost. Composed long before the birth of Christ and considered to be one of the most important pieces of Jewish mystical literature, it was only known from fragments and from references to it in other texts. All this changed, however, after polymath adventurer James Bruce of Kinnaird visited Ethiopia in the years 1770 to 1772. Amongst other remarkable achievements there, he procured and brought back to Britain several copies of the Book of Enoch that in antiquity had been translated into Ge'ez, the Ethiopic sacred language. These were the first complete copies ever to be seen in Europe. I note in passing that the Book of Enoch has always been of great significance to Freemasonry. Indeed, certain Masonic rituals, in curious resonance with Islamic traditions, identify Enoch with the ancient Egyptian wisdom god Thoth and also with his Greek avatar Hermes. An entry in the Royal Masonic Cyclopedia, first published in 1877, tells us that Enoch was the inventor of writing, that he taught men the art of building, and that before the flood he feared that the real secrets would be lost, to prevent which he concealed the grand secret, engraven on a white oriental porphyry stone in the bowels of the earth. The Cyclopedia contains its own hint of a secret tradition transmitted down the ages when it further suggests that Enoch was himself a Freemason, and that at the end of his days on earth, he delivered up the Grand Master's office to Lamech. The Book of Enoch is a very strange document, purporting, amongst many other elements, to be a vision of the future cataclysm of the flood and why it is to be unleashed upon the world. In a series of dreams, Enoch receives advance notice of the warning that God will give to his descendant Noah, that a deluge is about to come upon the whole earth and destroy all that is on it. This, of course, is familiar ground, merely a précis or restatement of what we can read in Genesis. So too is the passage that follows, in which Enoch is given to understand that arrangements will be made for Noah to escape, so that his seed may be preserved for all the generations of the world. What comes next is intriguing. Regardless of the fact that the express purpose of God's deluge is to kill off most of mankind, apart, of course, from Noah and his descendants, there is talk of the need to heal the earth, which the angels have corrupted, that all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things which the watchers have disclosed and have taught their sons. This is only the second mention of these mysterious watchers in the Book of Enoch. The first, a few pages earlier, tells us nothing about them except that they shall quake at the prospect of the coming events. So far, we have no real clue as to who or what they are, except that they have transgressed some divine law by teaching secret things, apparently dangerous things, to humanity, and that they and most of the human race, through the agency of the deluge, are to be punished grievously because of this. Certain names of the Watchers, or at any rate the leadership of the Watchers, are given. Azazel, Semjaza, Armen, Rumjal, Turel, Armaros, Danjal, Kokabel, and about a dozen more. More specifically, we are told about the nature of the secret things that they taught to mankind. And Azazel taught men to make swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working them, and bracelets and ornaments, and the use of antimony, and the beautifying of the eyelids, and all kinds of costly stones, and all colouring tinctures. And there arose much godlessness, and they committed fornication, and they were led astray, and became corrupt in all their ways. Semjaza taught enchantments and root cuttings, Armaros the resolving of enchantments, Barakwijal taught astrology, Kokabel the constellations, Ezekiel the knowledge of the clouds, Araquiel the signs of the earth, Shamsiel the signs of the sun, and Sariel the course of the moon. Next, we begin to understand that the Watchers are divided into two mutually opposed groups, because we read that the leaders of one group summon Enoch, remember this is all happening to him while he's in a dreamlike, visionary state, to deliver a message to the leaders of the other group, named as the Watchers of the Heaven. It seems that these Watchers of the Heaven, sometimes also referred to as the Heavenly Watchers, have defiled themselves with women, and have done as the children of the earth do, and have taken unto themselves wives. They have also wrought great destruction upon the earth. For this they're going to be punished in various deeply unpleasant and terrifying ways. Obedient and dutiful, Enoch sets off, bearing his heavy message of murder and mayhem from the Watchers to the Watchers. So what's going on here? A more careful scan of the pages reveals the backstory. And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another, Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children. And Semjaza, who was their leader, said unto them, I fear ye will not indeed agree to do this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin. And they all answered him and said, Let us all swear an oath, and all bind ourselves by mutual imprecations not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing. Then swear they all together, and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it, and they were in all 200, who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon. Now things are becoming clearer. Watchers is a general term referring to angels. Amongst them are bad angels. They want to have sex and make babies with beautiful human women, and while they're at it, as we can gather from passages quoted earlier, they're going to teach mankind a thing or two about metals and the constellations and the course of the sun and the moon, or the ecliptic, as this course, this path, is known to astronomers today. As the first step in implementing their plan, these bad watchers descend upon Mount Hermon, which happens to be in ancient Canaan, now the Lebanon, and only 45 miles, 73 kilometers, from Baalbek. Meanwhile, there are good angels, the holy angels who watch, amongst them Uriel, Raphael, Raguel, Michael, Saraquel, Gabriel, and Remiel. And it is these good watcher angels who appear to Enoch in a dream and give him that message of death and destruction to take to the bad watcher angels on Mount Hermon. He tells us specifically where he received this dream. I went off and sat down at the waters of Dan to the south of the west of Hermon. I fell asleep, and behold, a dream came to me, and visions fell down upon me, and I saw visions of chastisement, and a voice came, bidding me to tell it to the sons of heaven and reprimand them. And when I awakened, I came unto them. As I read these passages set before the flood, when the people of the Lebanon and ancient Turkey were still at the hunter-gatherer stage of development, it seems more and more obvious to me that Enoch is a shamanic figure. And like all shamans, everywhere, in all times and places, he sets great store by visions, which in his case come in the form of dreams received in sleep. What's interesting, however, is that when he wakes up from his visionary state, he's able to go to a real, physical place on Mount Hermon, where the Bad Watchers are, and talk to them face to face. "And I recounted before them all the visions which I had seen in sleep, and I began to speak the words of righteousness and to reprimand the heavenly watchers." Does this not suggest, rather strongly, that the Bad Watchers are physical beings? I don't know what the Good Watchers are, because they only appear to Enoch in his dreams. Quite possibly they are real at some level. Readers of my book Supernatural, which is about shamanism, will know my view that in altered states of consciousness, including dream states, the receiver wavelength of the brain may be retuned, allowing us to make contact with other dimensions of reality. But in Enoch's story, the Bad Watchers must be real, real on the earthly plane of physical existence, because when he wakes up, he's able to climb Mount Hermon and reprimand them. We must also entertain the possibility that the Bad Watchers, whoever or whatever they are, may not, in fact, be bad. All we can say is that they are judged to be bad and portrayed as bad in Enoch's dream visions. One possibility that we should keep in mind, alongside the alternative possibility that the Book of Enoch is just an ancient work of fantasy fiction, is that Enoch's encounters with the Bad Watchers really did happen, and that he hated and resented them for changes they were seeking to introduce to the hunter-gatherer way of life of his people. In that case, the reprimands he delivers to them, mediated through his subconscious as coming from the Good Watchers, might simply express his own deeply entrenched views, the views of a bigoted old shaman who feels threatened by change, even though he himself will later be transformed by his contacts with the Watchers. There isn't space here to review the entire bizarre, impenetrable, wildly suggestive text of the Book of Enoch. What I'm interested in is the much more specific possibility that the 200 Watchers, who descended on Mount Hermon, were indeed real beings, not phantasms. I'd like to understand more about what kind of beings they could have been, and I want to look at the picture Enoch paints of them, laden with hatred and resentment though it is, as bringing skills and sciences to our ancestors. Skills and sciences which ultimately will also be revealed to him by the Good Watchers, and with which his own name will come to be associated in legend and tradition. Mystery of the Nephilim. The Watchers begin their development project in quite small ways, teaching charms and enchantments and the cutting of roots to humans, and making them acquainted with plants. This sounds fairly harmless. Apart from a bit of enchantment, it's not really above and beyond basic hunter-gatherer level skills. But pretty soon, as we saw earlier, our ancestors are being initiated into the secrets of metals, and how to make swords and knives, and how to study the heavens, and also how to beautify themselves with eye makeup and jewelry. In return, a bit like the GIs who allegedly bought favors from British women with gifts of nylon stockings, cigarettes, and chewing gum during World War II, the Watchers are getting sex. Lots of sex. And it seems this is what annoys Enoch the most. He speaks reprovingly, again and again, of the fornication of the Watchers, of their lust for beautiful and comely human women who they sleep with, go into, and defile themselves with, and to whom they reveal all kinds of sins. From such admonishments, we may reasonably deduce a number of things about the Watchers, most particularly that they must be about the right size and shape, and equipped, moreover, with the necessary organs and impulses to want, to have, and to enjoy sex with human women. To me, the obvious conclusion from this is that the Watchers are, in fact, human, or at any rate, extremely closely related at the genetic level to anatomically modern human beings, close enough indeed to make human women pregnant and to have children of fornication with them. These offspring are not sickly, as one might expect from an even slightly mismatched genetic makeup. On the contrary, they thrive so vigorously that Enoch, or the good angel speaking through him, want not only to destroy the Watchers, but also to destroy the children of the Watchers. But there is something very odd about the hybrid.